I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short. Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear the first part of an interview between radio show host Kevin Barrett of No Lies Radio and the author of many 9/11 books, Dr. David Ray Griffin. And that will be followed by a 9/11 poem put to music, all done by two local artists. So first for the interview, Kevin Barrett has a weekly radio show on No Lies Radio out of San Francisco. Their website is noliesradio.org. And Dr. David Ray Griffin has written over 10 fact-filled books on 9/11, including The New Pearl Harbor, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, Debunking 9/11 Debunking, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, and The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center Building 7, to name just a few. So here's the first part of that interview from April 19th, 2011.
Today, we are very blessed to feature a guy I think is perhaps the most important voice that needs to be listened to in this century. David Ray Griffin, Professor Emeritus of Philosophy and Religion from Claremont College of California, is widely, if not universally, regarded as the top generalist scholar on the question of what really happened on 9/11. His books on the subject are the place to begin for anyone who is serious about researching this issue. And he has been doing wonderful work, bringing out book after book exactly at the time that particular book is needed. His book, The New Pearl Harbor, kicked off the scholarly study of 9/11 and kicked up the 9/11 truth movement a couple of notches in its quality of discussing the evidence that 9/11 wasn't what it appeared. And his most recent book on Cass Sunstein, The Cognitive Infiltration and Obama Appointees' Plan to Undermine the 9/11 Truth Movement, carries on with that tradition of very carefully examining questions surrounding 9/11 and concluding that there is something very rotten in Denmark. It's wonderful to have him back after having some health problems that have kept him off of this show and others for quite some time, since last summer at least. Welcome, David Ray Griffin. How are you, David?
I'm doing fine, Kevin. It's good to be back with you.
Well, it sure is wonderful to have you back. We've all been praying for you, and we realize just how big your contribution has been, and we really kind of need you to stay with us until we win this thing. It's a long struggle, as you know. Let's go back to when you first began reexamining 9/11. At that time, you were, I think, in your final year or two of teaching philosophy and religion. And, you know, I remember at that time when I first heard that you were writing The New Pearl Harbor and that you would be talking about the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center and the evidence that no 757 hit the Pentagon, my reaction was, oh, my goodness. You know, I'd heard these theories vaguely on the Internet, but I hadn't really taken them seriously. And when I heard that you were taking them seriously, I went and looked at them and saw that, by golly, you were right. There was a problem here. Now, how is it that a philosopher and theologian like yourself, working out of the Christian tradition, which is not usually associated with the search for empirical truth, was able to see these basically empirical and scientific problems in the official version of, say, the Trade Center collapses, well in advance of people like architect Richard Gage, who only figured it out thanks to hearing you on the radio?
Well, actually, I was rather late getting into the movement. A colleague mentioned that visiting my school, the School of Theology at Claremont, in 2003, and one of my students said, you know, you've got to listen to this guy. He says that 9/11 was an inside job. And I thought, well, that was pretty wild, but I would certainly want to listen to his ideas. And I talked to him for about an hour, and we concluded with my saying, well, I would need to see the evidence, and he said he would send some websites. So I received those the next day or two, and spent a couple hours maybe going through them, and didn't find it convincing. So I just went back to the work I was doing at the time. But then later in the year, actually in the early part of 2003, I received a letter from a friend saying that there was this website that I should take a look at. This was a colleague I had met at an economics conference, and I started going through it and saw very quickly that there were literally dozens of stories that had appeared once, and usually only once, in the mainstream press that contradicted the official story. And so that was what got me started. Now, you ask about the empirical, and why would a philosopher or a theologian get interested in such things? A lot of people don't understand the development of modern theology. As it developed in the 18th century, you had a basic division between those who continued the dogmatic tradition of taking things on faith and taking things in the Bible and the church documents, the meetings where they established various documents, and took those as authoritative, and theologians were ones who were supposed to deal with those authoritative statements. But in the 18th century, you had another movement developing, which was an empirical and rational movement, and said that theology, just like anything else, must be based on experience and evidence and must be cogent, must be rationally coherent. And in the 20th century, you even had a movement known as empirical theology. And the professor I studied with at Claremont was in that tradition, which was at the University of Chicago. And so for me, I mean, when I hear people talk about theologians, they're talking about something that's very different from what we at Claremont were doing. So for me, to deal with issues of science and religion, and to deal with empirical issues, that's not unusual. that's what we do.
Right.
So it was not particularly a big step to start looking at the issue about 9/11.
Right, and I did understand that at the time, which is why I took your work seriously. You'd written some books that are among the best that I knew about, treating certain kinds of empirical issues. And so I suppose 9/11 is just a very important empirical issue with philosophical and theological implications. In terms of the question of evil, which is one of the eternal questions of theology and philosophy, many of us feel that there's something about 9/11 that just has a being an inside job that seems to reveal something of the evil of those in power that did this. Do you share the take that there is a real kind of tangible almost entity that we could call evil, and that it characterizes the people who did 9/11 and the 9/11 wars?
Yeah, I wouldn't say an entity, but as you know, the problem of evil, along with science and religion, those were my big topics. They were the ones I wrote two books, or actually three books, on the problem of evil. And I think that was another factor that led me to take 9/11 seriously, is that there are still certain people who say, with regard to 9/11, oh, that's just impossible because our leaders wouldn't do such a thing. Even Bush and Cheney would, you know, they might do some questionable things, but they wouldn't do unspeakable evil, just deliberately murdering American citizens in order to further their geopolitical goals. Well, you know, we had a long history of the inhumanity of man to man, the expression we used to use. That there's nothing unusual about leaders doing these kinds of things. And we know that, the European tradition that we came out of. But when the Americans came here, they said, well, we're starting anew, and there was a lot of evil. I mean, the European traditions were very evil, but we're not that way. Our people are good and just wouldn't do. So a lot of people have still believe that we are the exceptional country and that our leaders simply wouldn't do such a thing. And so I think my long dealing with the problem of evil helped me properly to entertain that idea fairly early, because there's just no evidence that living in a different continent protect people from unspeakable evil.
That's right, yeah. The whole American exceptionalism that says that our country is so different from all the others really doesn't hold up under scrutiny. In terms of that sense that so many people have that our leaders here in the USA wouldn't do anything that evil, I think that may be a factor that has made it easier for some people to embrace what has been sometimes called in the 9/11 truth movement lie hop, or let it happen on purpose. That is the idea that the Muslim radical terrorists were going to do this thing, and that the U.S. authorities sort of looked the other way and let it happen. That still leaves the foreign entity, the Muslim radicals, with the majority of responsibility for doing it, and simply says that the American authorities sort of looked the other way and saves them from being completely blamed. And in that debate, which went on for a while and seems to have been won in general by those who say that it was an inside job through and through, one of the issues that's come up is the issue of the Pentagon. And it seems to me that there, some folks say that it's very important to not make any statements that we can't completely back up. And since there is a chance that a 757 really did hit the Pentagon, and some of these people actually seem to believe that it did, that the truth movement should stay away from questioning that and instead ask questions about, well, how could they have hit the Pentagon? They, of course, could still be the radical Muslim hijackers at that stage. So what's your take on the Pentagon issue in general, and in particular the hot-button issue in the 9/11 truth movement about what really happened there?
Okay, let me back up for a second to that issue of the lie hop, because there are still people doing radio interviews suggesting that, maybe our leaders did it, but also maybe, as you say, they just allowed the Muslims to attack the Pentagon and attack the World Trade Center. Well, you mentioned the fact that I had done a lot of work with the World Trade Center. This is the thing that is most firmly established now empirically in the 9/11 movement, is that the World Trade Center, the Twin Towers and Building 7 were brought down. There's simply no question about it when you look at the evidence, and the evidence is multiple types of evidence that we need not go through here, but I've gone through at great length in various books and articles. So the response to the lie hop movement is simply to say, you can't just allow the World Trade Center to come down. You've got to make it come down, right. And you have to make it come down by planting the various kinds of explosives in the building. It's a very difficult matter. It's a very delicate matter. It's an art or a science of controlled demolition. To bring that down so that 7 buildings, and only 7 buildings destroyed, and in this case, 3 buildings that came down all the way and very quickly, almost at free fall acceleration. This was a very, very expert enterprise that was carried on there. So that once you realize that, the lie hop scenario is simply impossible. You can't just allow those buildings to come down.
I actually completely agree with you about that. And further, I would argue that controlled demolition of these Trade Center buildings proves that there couldn't have been any Muslim hijackers flying the planes, because whoever had elaborately set up those demolitions could not have been 99% sure that any such hijackers would get control of the planes, much less actually hit the targets, especially at the speeds that they were clocked at. So you understand that. I understand that. But my mother doesn't. My mother, after hearing this from me for years and resisting it mightily, finally came around a couple of years ago to admitting that, well, yes, these were controlled demolitions, but I still don't know who did it. And she's very much resisting pinning the blame on any particular person. And even Noam Chomsky, in email correspondence, told me that if we prove controlled demolition, it would simply prove that bin Laden did it. So it seems to me that it's possible for people in denial to have the spin masters convince them that even if these are controlled demolitions, they can't be sure who did it. And there are those who say that the Pentagon issue is important because there's absolutely no way you can spin setting off a bomb or hitting it with a missile and then claiming that it was hit by a plane.
Yeah, you know, neither one is intelligible, I would think. And it may be true that with regard to the Pentagon, it's even clearer. But when people really want to believe something, they generally find a way to do it. So I wouldn't put that past the public discussion of this to suggest that if they agree that, yes, there were bombs going off in the Pentagon, they might say, well, you know, those Muslim hijackers, those Al-Qaeda guys are very clever.
Mm-hmm. So, you're probably right. With people like my mom and Noam Chomsky. I don't usually lump those two together, by the way.
Well, in any case, with regard to should we stay away from the Pentagon because it's such a controversial issue, no, I would say the opposite. Because it's so controversial, we should spend more time on it. And one problem is simply the fact that the people who have real expertise with buildings have not worked very much on the Pentagon. I would say almost 99% of the work of people, say, in architects and engineers and other professional organizations, other than pilots for 9/11 Truth, have devoted almost all their attention to the World Trade Center. And maybe there are good reasons for that. But nevertheless, that now, for those of us in the movement, that has been established. And so I think it is time for us to devote in a rather full way that we hadn't before, work on the Pentagon. And I'm confident that once that is done, as we get real professionals, I mean people who are professionally experts about these matters, going through the official document about the Pentagon, we'll find all sorts of reasons beyond what we already know as to why the official story cannot possibly be true.
I think you're probably right about that. And I do hope there will be more professionals. I think some of the best work on the Pentagon so far has been done by Enver Massoud, who contributed to the book that you and I worked on, 9/11 in the American Empire, Volume 2. He's an engineer who has found all sorts of information, including the fact that the fire department apparently showed up before the biggest event, either the main explosion or whatever it was that happened there. And also Barbara Honecker, who is a professional military affairs journalist, has done quite good work. I hope that that work will be backed up by people who are very careful and open-minded and objective. And not, as there seem to be some people, maybe it's just me, but it seems to me there are a few people out there who have done good work on the trade centers who have not been very open-minded in weighing the evidence about all the different potential alternatives at the Pentagon, and who have been too quick to criticize good researchers, such as Enver Massoud and Barbara Honecker and the CIT guys. But that's such a hot button issue, I don't want you to say anything too controversial about it.
Well, I'm perfectly open to saying things that are controversial. But I think that's the case, that with the World Trade Center, there were those of us who were not what you would call professional in the field with architects and engineers. And we had to talk, we talked about this for many, many years before the really professional people got involved with this. And it's the same thing with the Pentagon. You've mentioned some good work, but we're talking about thus far one engineer who's devoted serious work to the Pentagon. And whereas with the World Trade Center, we have literally dozens and hundreds of people who have done work on that. So that's what I'm suggesting, that it is time now to move over to that and not to be frightened by charges that this is beyond the pale or that somehow we already know. I think we need to start from pretty much from scratch and to deal with what people such as Barbara Honegger have dealt with and see how it shapes up along with all the other information about the construction of the building and how the official story shapes up once we look at that. Because with the World Trade Center, the official story falls apart completely. Nothing remains with that. And I suspect the same thing will be with the case with regard to the Pentagon.
Well, I do too. I don't know if you heard, but last week at this time I had William Veal, who's April Gallup's lawyer, in her appeal of her lawsuit, which was initially turned down against Cheney, Rumsfeld, and others. I don't know if you heard this, but it was just stunning to me that, you know, William Veal came on and he was still stunned himself walking, you know, out of that courtroom. The three judges who were judging his appeal turned down his motion to have Judge Walker recuse himself for obvious conflict of interest because Judge Walker is the uncle of then-President George W. Bush, whose administration is being accused of having perpetrated the 9/11 attacks. And this three-judge panel turned down that motion for Judge Walker to recuse himself, and Judge Walker stayed there on the panel. And what William Veal was actually flabbergasted that this guy is, he actually is, he's a perfect spitting image of George H.W. Bush. Can you believe it, that this character thinks that he has no conflict of interest in a case charging that his nephew presided over the worst crime in American history?
We've had so many things that are beyond belief, but this, you know, we get to the point where we say, well, we can't get anything more outrageous than what we've already learned, but here they did it. And that's one of the problems with our system, that it's a voluntary matter to recuse himself. There needs to be, and so they're starting with regard to one of the Supreme Court justices, the question has come up. And so some people are now starting to think about there needs to be some sort of external committee that would make these decisions and not just leave it up to people, say, well, I think I can be unbiased. And in this case, you say it is so obvious, and yet because it's 9/11, they can get away with almost anything because nobody wants to be on the side of defending the kooks like us who hold that 9/11 was an inside job, or even in April Gallup's case, that there was not a really full-size plane there, that, you know, you know the story, and you talked about it here. She walked right out of that hole that's supposed to be where the plane hit, and she didn't have the slightest idea that the plane, that anybody was going to say that a 757 size of plane had hit the Pentagon right where she and her son were. And they told her, yes, when they got to the hospital, yes, it was really a plane, and they wanted her to sign off on this, and she wouldn't do it. For anybody who hadn't heard this story, it's just, that story by itself is pretty outrageous. And now add on top of that the Walker debacle.
Right. It really just makes you wonder, you know, what kind of people we're dealing with here. You know, Shameless, I guess, you know, he wins the Larry Silverstein Award for Shameless Chutzpah. Larry got for having confessed to demolishing Building 7 on national television and then walking into court and demanding $750 million in insurance money on Building 7 plus billions of other dollars for his other buildings.
We should probably have the top 10 of the most outrageous developments in the 9/11 case.
Right, or the Chutzpah Award, or the shamelessness award. There would be quite a few people competing there, I guess.
That was an interview between radio show host Kevin Barrett and author Dr. David Ray Griffin. Tune in next week to hear the conclusion of that interview. And for the poem Turn to Song, Hartford resident Joanne Bauer wrote this poem called Redeeming Truth. A musician and host of the Middletown Cable Access TV show 9/11 Illumination, Gary Fox, put it to music. So here it is, Redeeming Truth.
Five days after 9/11, in a gathering of stunned community, we met an artist who unveiled his sculpture from that devastated morning. An unlikely fusion of bronze and glass captured the ungraspable. Onlookers, again we relived the ravages of that day, etched in metal and memory. Nine years later, the horror billows wider. Dense smoke betrays the watchful eye. We have not outrun the blue sky turned ashen, nor escaped the tall stories in free fall. Caught in blinding white lies, we have tripped over bodies of evidence. First hidden, now recovered tracks, minute as nanothermite or glaring as molten steel. Piece by unraveling piece, rivet our gaze.
And again, that was Redeeming Truth, a poem written by Joanne Bauer and put to music by Gary Fox. It's a great piece from two local artists. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.